Spoilerpod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to our very special spoiler podcast for Thor, The Dark World, the latest salvo of Marvel's ongoing plans for world domination, in which Asgard is attacked by a terrible threat that forces Thor, the Norse god of thunder, to turn to an unexpected ally for help, his stepbrother, Loki. Joining me to talk about this latest Phase 2 installment are scholars from the University of Midgard, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Dan Jolin.
Greetings.
Didn't expect that. And Ali Plum.
Greetings.
I expected that. Hello all. Before we move on, a reminder that this is the spoiler podcast, and I wrote that in capitals. We'll be delving into the Dark World in great spoilerific detail, including the ending and the post-credit stings and everything. So if you haven't seen it, run along, rectify that situation immediately, and then come right back here. For the rest of you, you're in for a treat, for before the four of us witter on at length, Helen and I spoke to Tom Hiddleston, a.k.a. Loki, director Alan Taylor, and Marvel head honcho producer Kevin Feige, and milked them from movie fact juice. Here's what they had to say, starting with Feige and Taylor, and then we'll segue seamlessly into Tom Hiddleston. Now there's a sentence. Here you enjoy. Fantastic. I do want to talk about one thing that does seem to be setting up something for later films, and that's the last shot of the film, which is very, very interesting indeed. Loki on the throne of Asgard.
Oops, now you've spoiled it.
Now I've spoiled it. There's a cat out of the bag. Was that always planned, or was that quite late in the day? And
God, this is a really interesting process. You answer that one.
Well, it's always a combination on our films, because we have ideas early on, and we want to be rigid enough, as you might imagine a producer needs to be, to start building those elements. But we also want to be able to be loose enough to have things come up as they may. So it was always the plan that Loki have a redemptive death. And it was always planned that he wouldn't really be gone, because in the comic books, that's not what happened. So there were various discussions as to where we would leave him. But as the process was building and continuing, you know, really a shape of a, we never really talk about, a trilogy necessarily, but I've just seen that they're starting to do some Thor marathons around the world, gearing up to the release of The Dark World. and that marathon is Thor, The Avengers, and Thor, The Dark World. Mm-hmm. And when people see all three of those together, particularly with that last shot, mm-hmm. you essentially see a trilogy about Loki getting what he always wanted and taking the most roundabout way he possibly could. But this kid who we first meet alongside his young brother, being told by his father that they were both born to be kings, and then very quickly learning that's not true, and then soon after that learning, not only is that not true, you're not even really an Asgardian, you're not even the son of Odin, you belong to this hated and despised species, and he has a misguided attempt to try to win the love of his father back, which his father rightfully rejects, mm-hmm. and he ends up letting go and plummeting himself into the abyss. Mm-hmm. And Avengers is all about his grandstanding and his attempt to get a throne somewhere else. And when we meet him at the beginning of The Dark World, he's lost and he's a broken man. My favorite shot in the movie is Thor coming to see Loki, and Loki standing up in front of him proudly, trying to ask why he's coming to see him now, and Thor saying, "Knock it off, man, knock it off." And the illusion peels back, and you see the entire place is in shambles, and he's got a bloody foot, and he's just sitting there with his hair all messed up, you know, being as broken as we've ever seen him. And that he's able to spin the events of his brother without ever really lying to his brother, without ever actually betraying his brother, into what he's always wanted, which is sitting on the
throne.
And
saving his brother at one point.
Yeah. Absolutely. and you know, we love the notion that last scene needed to work for people watching the movie for the first time, who believed it's Odin talking to Thor, and then the surprise. But it needs to work when people watch it a second and third time. Why is Odin saying those things? Why is Loki saying those things to Thor? And they're very nice things, and they're very caring things that he says to him. Is that partially because he really does love his brother? I like to think so. Mm-hmm. Is that also because he thinks that's what his brother needs, to leave and not come back? Perhaps.
I also like watching it, the second time watching Anthony Hopkins' Odin listen to how Thor talks about Loki. It's clever.
Yeah. It's a really small moment there, but it's absolutely really
He good offers thing. Up the hammer, and Odin pauses for a minute. And when you know it's really Loki, he's realizing, well, I'm not going to be able to lift it anyway.
That's going to be awkward.
Just keep it. It's yours.
Yeah, I have to say, we were looking in retrospect at our subscribers cover.
The secrets are often and right in front of you.
It's right there, and none of us noticed.
It's on the cover of Empire magazine.
It's on the cover of the magazine.
That's right.
None of us spotted it. It's quite embarrassing.
It's amazing.
But there you go. But I remember reading in the production notes that Anthony Hopkins said he hadn't shot any scenes with Tom. So that opening scene with the two of them, was that quite a late addition as well?
That was added, yes. We always have additional photography on all of our movies. And I like to think that over the years, people realize that that means improving the movie, having a good idea, and having the resources and the ability to execute those ideas, as opposed to the old-fashioned notion that might apply to some films but don't apply to most of our films, which is, uh-oh, reshoots, they're in trouble, uh-oh, they got
to
do it
yeah,
again.
Yeah, I've been very careful just to say the word, you know, additional photography instead of reshoots, because even coming out of TV, when the word reshoot comes along, it's somebody screwed up.
But, you know, so many of the best moments in all of our movies were shot in the post period. As part of an additional photography, we schedule it for all of our movies. We never know what it's going to be necessarily, but we always know or hope that as we're cutting the movie together, that more things will come to light and more possibilities will present themselves. So we always schedule the actor's time and some production time and some financing put aside to do additional photography. And yes, that scene, that opening scene with Loki in shackles being led in front of Odin was shot in that later period.
I mean, it was partly expositional enhancement, but it was also part of this phase where we realized just how much Loki was, you know, connecting with the audience. And so there was also the other late addition was what seems to be people's favorite scene now of the
shape-shifting
scene as he walks out of the prison. And that came very, very late, and that was just there only to let Loki be Loki, kind of.
And call Chris Evans and get him in. And
Well, he was shooting Captain America: The Winter Soldier right down the street, so he was able to come in and do that for us.
But what's nice is that Tom did that role, and then Chris Evans came in and watched Tom's performance of Chris Evans doing so, and then he imitated Tom's imitation of Chris Evans.
And that will be on the Blu-ray. You'll be able to actually see Hiddleston in the cap suit.
He says he fitted perfectly. No adjustments were necessary.
He put it right on.
I don't know whether he's, you know,
he seemed really happy about that.
I think he didn't want to take it off.
But is there a markedly different version of this movie then? Because there's also in the Empire feature, Christopher Eccleston talks about having scenes or a confrontation with Odin and Malekith, which is not in the film anymore. So did that fall by the wayside?
There's a process that goes on, which is finding the movie a little bit and also tightening things up. And it's always going to be the case that some things that you love have to go away. And so I spent some time with Chris Eccleston, you know, yesterday, and that was probably the scene that he missed. I'm hoping that gets, you know, seen in Blu-ray. But it's part of making the film more focused and more. And I think in that particular case, you're serving big things. You know, Thor had to come in and continue the arc that he was on, and even though it's a wonderful, wonderful scene with great work done by all the actors, in the flow of the movie, it's frequently the, you know, most beloved things that have to go.
You have this invasion scene almost, and then you slow it down, I guess, to have this.
We did, and we, you know, we needed to get Thor, as I recall it, to sort of there to contend with the villain, and we sort of stopped.
There was a showdown, and frankly, one of the lines is in the first trailer, teaser.
Yeah.
That Malekith says, which is good, and references sacrifices he's had to make in the past, and sort of confronting Odin on what is he willing to sacrifice, referring, of course, to Frigga, who's at the end of a knife blade. But what happened was, and it was nobody's fault except our own, really, that we had constructed a scene that was shot beautifully by Alan, that was performed beautifully by the actors. But what we asked them to do was a mistake. And basically what that is Odin put down his spear. Mm-hmm. That Malekith successfully talked Odin into putting down his spear and then kills Frigga anyway. Mm-hmm. And the early audiences went, what the hell is he, why would he do that? Odin wouldn't do that. Mm. Odin would blast him. Odin would do something. He would absolutely wouldn't do that. And they rioted in the theater and they took their pitchforks and their tomatoes.
Pour out the seats.
You know, thankfully, because it was such a good scene, we did a little more photography for that scene. But the version that you see in the movie now was cut using mainly all the original versions of the scene with an additional line here or there, and has Odin entering afterwards. So in other words, the audience could forgive him that he was too late, that he had been sidelined because of the invasion happening in his throne room and across Asgard, but they could not forgive him for sort of wimping out and putting the spear down. And when we changed it to the version of the scene you see in the movie, scores, you know, we do test screenings and we look at scores and the numbers do not dictate everything to us. But when they're overwhelming, you know, you know, there's something going on. They shot up and suddenly people loved and respected Odin again.
Just speaking of Malekith talking about sacrifice, there's a lot of kind of echoes in this movie between kind of warring pairs, if you like, because there's the, you know, he sacrificed his people and Odin at one point is willing to do the same. You've got, you know...
Isn't it exciting that they actually know that?
That can make this connection. That
we work so hard to actually get that to play in a movie. It works.
And now, funny, with the ending of Thor stepping away from the throne, it also delivers on that at the end, which was actually a late evolution in his character.
Well, it was just, it was obviously well constructed, so I just wanted to say, you know, I spotted it. Well done.
Very good to hear.
One of my favorite Kevin quotes was... at some point in the process saying, you don't have to know what you're doing, you have to look like you know what you're doing.
I live my life by that. But in terms of, you mentioned Frigga there, and I think people went in this movie expecting a big death. Can you talk about at which point you decided it would be, well, Loki as well, but Frigga as well? I think a lot of people were expecting maybe Odin.
Maybe there. We're recollecting this different, because you probably had a lot of development before I even got there, but when I got there... it was pretty clear that Frigga was going to die because there was very, very few things we could do that would pull the brothers together, that would believably be a motive for both of them. And actually, Loki's death, I think, came as an idea a little later in the process. And then we had to figure out you know, what that meant to the universe and how to handle it and how real was it and so on. But the central event, even in the first draft I read, was going to be the death of Frigga and what that meant to all the other characters. And I love the fact that Renee Russell has you know, more to do in this. People seem really... surprised by how fierce she comes across as a warrior, and she's also funny, and
she's great in the movie. And that's right. That was an early idea to link the brothers and to give Loki a reason to help Thor, because Odin would be very tragic to the audience, would be very tragic to Thor, but perhaps not to Loki.
As evidenced by his final line.
That's right.
I didn't do it for him.
So where is Odin?
it is a good question. We have some ideas. I could answer it, but I won't.
But this is the spoiler section. Oh, but not that spoiler.
Not that spoiler. Spoiling
not
something
phase
else.
Phase 3, phase 4 spoiler.
And then I just want to ask also about one of the mid-credit sting rather than the post-credit sting. I was on set of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, great.
Very excited about that. What did confuse one of my colleagues is that, and I just want to completely clarify it, that was the ether, is also an infinity stone. Is this correct?
That is correct. Odin talks about it when he goes to the Hall of Science in Asgard. You hear him talk about relics that predate the universe itself, and that while many of these are in the shapes of stones, the ether is fluid and ever-changing. But it is, as revealed in that tag, one of the infinity stones, as is the Tesseract. Mm-hmm. Revealed for the first time in that.
So when did you shoot that? And who shot that?
James Gunn shot it. It's part of our sort of fun tradition of the passing the torch, the next filmmaker filming a tag. Ken Branagh shot the tag that's on the end of Iron Man 2. Joss Whedon shot the tag that's on the end of the original Thor.
That means I'm going to come knocking for a job in several, you know, years. Because we were mixing in L.A. at the same time. He was shooting on his own sets in London. So
we had Ray and Jamie... thankfully, we're able and willing to fly to the Guardian set to shoot that for us.
So, in terms of the story, I mean, it's the first time we see the Collector, which is interesting.
Yes.
A little teaser of the Guardians universe we can expect. And the second time around I watched it, it kind of struck me what Benicio del Toro was doing. He's essentially doing... this is almost Finster's brother from the Usual Suspects. Is that
intergalactic Finster?
Yeah,
slightly more intelligible.
I will never claim to know what Benicio is doing, but he's doing whatever it is. It's pretty awesome. And you know what we are hoping for is that in the same way that people who stay through the end credits of Iron Man were treated to Sam Jackson showing up in an eye patch and a leather coat in Tony Stark's living room. A small segment of the audience would know, oh my God, that's Nick Fury. That means there could be the Avengers. A large segment of the audience went, well, what the hell is Sam Jackson doing at the end of this movie? What does that mean? Why does he have an eye patch? And soon a conversation was developing about who that is and what that means. And likewise, I think there'll be some people who go, oh, that's the Collector. He's in Guardians. And there'll be a lot of people who go, what the heck is Benicio del Toro doing? What is this?
What happened to his hair?
Yeah, why? Why? What is going on? Is that a pink lady? that inspires the conversation that will lead us to Guardians of the Galaxy.
I hope they don't get to that point and then turn off the movie because they think they've had their Marvel treat at the end. Because there's another Marvel treat at the very end of the credits with one of my favorite shots in the movie at the very last shot.
What's the name of that animal? Is it a bilge snipe?
It is not a bilge snipe, but the amount of questions I get about bilge snipe is pretty amazing. It's a testament to Joss's line in Avengers. It is a frost creature from Jotunheim. a slightly smaller, perhaps baby version of what we saw in the first Thor film, that Thor flew through the back of his head.
Absolutely. Very, very playful version. This
it was lovely,
around.
Wasn't it?
Still chasing birds.
I think the RSPCA need to get on that one sooner or later.
I live near Greenwich, so I was a bit worried about all that.
It's interesting as well because you did, as you did with Avengers, two post-credits scenes in this one. And I've developed a theory, which is if something develops the larger story of the phases, then that comes at the midpoint. And if it doesn't, then you leave it till the end almost as a thank you for staying through the movie. Is that...
That is an excellent observation. Yes.
But with the Thor and Jane reunion at the end of this movie, was that intended always to be there, or did you intend to have it at the end of the movie proper?
It was. We experimented with a few places for it, to be honest, and no, we didn't shoot it saying, "Oh, we're going to put this." That we know that this will go at the end. But the truth was that after that Loki reveal, you can't go back.
Nothing could follow that in the story. But also, there's this funny development where we spent a lot of agony thinking, how do we explain that they're together? And until somebody woke up and said, you don't have to explain it. They love each other. They, you know, it's sort of natural that they would be together. So it sort of evolved from a kind of major plot point into a tag. Well, you know, of course, sort of at the end. Mm. But that was a late development too.
And I'm wondering about the mechanics of the bridge because, you know, I hope her home is structurally sound because he was landing on the roof. You know, it always seemed like it did a lot of damage to the ground. I was worried.
I think Heimdall is very precise in the way that he can dial, the landings.
So on one hand, he can, you know, target it at an army of dark elves and blow them away, or he can make sure not to knock over the plant pots.
Right.
Okay.
She may have to retar her roof occasionally.
I love the relationship between Thor and Jane in both movies. And in this movie, Natalie was saying at the press conference the other day about how it's so lovely she gets to meet the dad. And there's that lovely moment where she goes, "You told your dad about me."
Yeah, I love that. That's one of my favorites.
Which is great. But there's also hints that there's a love triangle set up going on, possibly with Sif. Is that something that you're maybe looking to resolve at a later date? Or?
Yeah, maybe. And you know, really, that's just a tip of the hat to the relationship in the comics. Because in the comics, yes, Sif does end up becoming a great, great love interest of Thor's after Jane Foster. And you know, if we're lucky enough to be asked to make additional movies, I think maybe we could lean that way and head that way. But for the time being, it was fun to you know, Jamie just does an amazing job at giving those glances and sort of looking at Jane up and down and, you know, what is she thinking? And really, this is who he chooses over me. And yet, she's unbelievably noble. She's a great warrior, and she assists in helping Jane along the way, which we thought was great for somebody to be very jealous of someone and yet support them and help them in the journey.
Yeah, so there's sort of, it's tiny, as you said, but it's got a little mini arc in there, sort of where she complains about her, gives her an eyeball, and then sort of saves her. But for me, coming to the Marvel Universe, I just love the fact that they combine, and we got a chance to combine this huge, epic, galactic stuff, and then trying to find the smallest, most even petty moments in the human behavior so that meeting dad or meeting mom is awkward. You know, your boyfriend didn't call you when he was in New York, jerk, slap. And also here, the women sort of eyeballing each other. The fact you pause and take the time to do a petty moment like that while the elves are attacking Asgard is my favorite kind of thing in the Marvel Universe.
And is it, I know that you're planning Phase 3, and I know you probably won't be able to say it, but the popularity of Loki, the final shot of this movie, are you thinking about a Thor 3? Are you thinking about a Loki movie spin-off?
We're thinking about lots of things. You know, where we specifically go, we'll see. You know, but the greatest part of sort of the groundswell of a Loki solo movie is what that really means. Yes, it means, yes, we want to see a Loki movie, but it really means is we love Loki. We love what you've done with Loki. We love what Tom Hiddleston has done with Loki. And I certainly hope that all of those people, you know, enjoy what we do in the Loki movie that's coming out now, which is Thor the Dark World.
But could Loki work without Thor?
I think anything is possible. I think if inspiration strikes and you have the right creative team, that you can, you know, you can make a great film out of almost anything. I think it would be somewhat challenging because so much of what is great about Thor is Loki, and what's so great about Loki is Thor. And both Tom and Chris have been very upfront and honest about that. Mm. And there are not a ton of singular Loki stories in the comics, I think, for that very reason. So, you know, we wouldn't do it just to go, he's really popular, quick, make a movie about him. We would only do it if we had an idea that could sustain a whole movie. And the truth is there's so many other great Loki Thor stories to tell first.
And indeed, great other Marvel stories. You've got Guardians is set, Avengers 2 is set, Captain America the Winter Soldier is set, Ant-Man is now happening.
Ant-Man is now officially happening from Comic-Con 2006, where we sat not in Hall H, but in one of the other ballrooms with Jon Favreau talking about his upcoming Iron Man and Louis Leterrier talking about his upcoming The Incredible Hulk and Edgar Wright talking about his upcoming Ant-Man. Mm. And little do we know, it would be so far flung into the future. But it is, things happen at the right time for the right reasons. And he is now in our offices in Burbank and officially prepping the movie to shoot next year.
Right now, it's like 5 in the morning.
Well, he might be sleeping right now.
Okay, okay.
Might be.
There's a lot of work to do. But it's one of the ones that I'm looking forward to the most in the Marvel Universe, the Ant-Man thing. Just because that combination of that story and that character, that director, I think could be so
cool. It's going to be interesting. Can you comment on the casting rumors that have been knocking around recently?
No, of course not. But we are just starting to cast and starting to look for, three or four main leads and main characters in the film. And I hope we have the majority of a cast before the end of the year, but nothing to announce yet.
Have you thought about casting an actual ant?
Well, believe it or not, Edgar Wright introduced me many years ago to, ironically, is it called Phase 4? What's that movie? What's that crazy?
Oh, yeah, Phase 4. It's all
Phase 4.
Yeah.
It didn't even occur to me. It's called Phase 4.
Yeah.
So we've been looking at a lot of practical ant footage for many, many years, some of which is unbelievably creepy, but much of which is sort of awe-inspiring. Whether we use real ants or not is part of what we're trying to figure out now in pre-production.
Okay, and the last question, gentlemen, then we'll let you go, is you're not going to talk about where Odin is, but Odin's last scene in the movie with the guard, who is actually Loki, at the very end of the last scene, Anthony Hopkins turns to the camera and goes and has a sort of knowing look in his face. So does he know that that is Loki, or is he sad about the death of his son? What's your take on it?
I think when we were doing it and when we were going through the takes, when we were picking takes, and when I was talking to Anthony, we wanted that to hang in the teeter. And not be decided. There's a look in his eye that I think is the glimmer of recognition of who he's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a kind of acknowledgement of that, I think, and a sort of weariness that comes with it. Oh, God. Sort of, which that can very much also read as, I'm so sad about the loss of my son, who I learned to love too late.
Yeah.
And because he's a brilliant actor, he can make both sit together.
Well said. No, it was supposed to work on both levels, and I think Tony came in to do a little ADR in that scene and had seen that and said, I'm not going to do an impression. I'll leave that to Tom Hiddleston.
Come on.
But basically, I think enjoyed that line, Loki, could be interpreted both ways.
Mm. I can't wait for the Rashomon-style sequel where we see the events from Odin's point of view. See what unfolds after that. But, gents, it's been a pleasure. Kevin,
thank you, Alan, so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Shall we move on now to the spoiler section? Helen, do you want to?
Okay,
I'll quickly move into it. So this is the spoiler section now, Tom. So we can talk hopefully
about everything
freely and openly about everything.
I will. I'll do my best. I have to take off the safety catch, which has been so firmly locked down for 12 months.
How much do you know, for example, let's talk about, I think the last shot in this movie is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Let's start at the end and work our way back.
Okay.
Loki is on the throne of Asgard.
He is.
How much do you know about the events that led up to that and what's in store for Loki? What are his plans?
So basically, the logic of it, and I hope people get this from the film, is let's go a bit further back. There's a moment when Thor and Loki are leaving the prison, and Loki's already messing around, and he does some shapeshifting, mm-hmm. And he changes into a guard, and then he changes Thor into Sif, and then he changes himself into Captain America.
Yes.
A marvelous imitation of an imitation by Chris Evans. I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute, but there's an actor who plays the guard that I turn into.
Yes.
Who is the same actor who plays the guard that comes back to tell Odin that they found a body on the Dark World.
Mm.
And so it's Loki's disguise. So in actual fact, when the Asgardian guard comes back to tell Odin, that's Loki saying we found a body.
And did you read those lines for him? Because he had your kind of cadence.
Yes,
to
I
those
did.
Lines.
Okay. Yeah, I did it, and then he did, as it were, an impression of me. He's fantastic. He's an Australian actor. And I wish I could remember his name.
We should look it up.
Yeah.
And give him due credit.
Mm.
That scene
ends with Odin turning towards the guard and giving him an almost knowing look.
Mm.
And that could be read a couple of ways. One, it could be read, Loki's dead and I'm actually quite sad about the death of my yeah. son. Or I know that that guard is Loki. What's your reading on that situation?
Hmm. I think it's deliberately ambiguous. I mean, I like, well, maybe one day we'll explore what happens after that moment.
I think it's setting up that way.
what happened? Does Loki reveal himself, or does he? That's the question. Like, what happens to Odin after that?
What have you done with Odin? That's what we want to know.
Yeah, because on our subscriber cover, we only realized this sort of on Friday after seeing the film. We were looking at that picture again, and there's a helmet sitting by Loki's feet, mm-hmm. and it's not his. It's Odin's.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we were like, oh. Darn. Totally didn't.
It's been there
that.
All along. It's I wonder if there were ever another film, you know, or maybe a tag scene or something where I wish I knew what was inside Kevin Feige's brain. I don't, sadly. And maybe one day there'll be some, you know, you'll be in a world where you least expect it. You'll be, you know, traveling in through and into a cityscape, a metropolis, and you know, past some cafes and shops, and you'll find an old man sitting on his own, and he'll turn to the camera, and it'll be Anthony Hopkins.
slightly bewildered, how the hell did I get
here? Yeah,
what's
yeah.
happened?
Yeah, but I think he's certainly put him away somewhere. I'm not. I mean, I don't know specifically where, and I have many ideas about what's happened, but. Yeah.
When did some of that happen? Because I was just reading in the production notes and Anthony Hopkins was saying, I didn't have any scenes with Tom this time. And I was thinking, yeah, you did. So yeah. Were those quite late in the day? I mean, that sort of that opening scene with him and then I guess a little bit at the end.
Yes, that the opening scene was something that came later. And I think it's great because I actually always wanted that scene. It was always... there was an idea that it would be assumed on the behalf of the audience that on the way into prison that Loki and Odin would have had this second confrontation because Odin hadn't seen Loki since the end of Kenneth Branagh's Thor when he disappears through the wormhole. And I thought, I want to play that scene. There's so much that's happened. What does Odin say about New York? What does he say about what happened in Avengers and how has Loki changed? So... that was the latest scene we shot, and I loved doing it. I mean, it, just to work with Tony Hopkins is amazing, and he really goes for it in this one too.
Oh yeah, when he explodes with rage, it's truly terrifying. I imagine to be on the end of that must be fairly scary.
Yeah, but also he's so playful, and that day I remember that particular day's work. He knew I was about to go and do. Coriolanus, and he'd played Coriolanus in Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre.
Wow.
So it was as a young man. Christopher Plummer pulled out, and a young Mr. Hopkins stepped into the breach. And so actually, the sort of like between takes, that whole day he was just telling me anecdote after anecdote after anecdote about working with Olivier and Richardson, and they got funnier and funnier and funnier. I mean, he is the best mimic I've ever seen. Like you get him to do his Laurence Olivier. That apocryphal story of they re-released Spartacus.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And they got him to do Olivier's ADR. Very, very funny indeed. So in between rages, it was all jokes and laughter.
And you talked about the imitation of an imitation of an imitation. That happened with Chris Evans.
Yes.
In this movie. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was amazing. I actually shot that. And there is a scene. I hope it's on. I think it's going to be on the DVD. I got into the Captain America costume.
Hey.
Yeah, it was great, and I'm pleased to say it fits rather well. didn't have to make any alterations. So basically, I played Captain America. I played Loki dressed as Captain America.
Yeah.
Because Chris Evans was still finishing the Winter Soldier, he wasn't around. He was off in wherever he was. And so I did it. And then the idea was they would show Chris the tape of me doing him or me doing him. And he was so game. He was so, he was like, oh my God, this is going to be great. I think he's fantastic, actually. So it's Chris Evans doing an impression of Loki doing an impression of Captain America. It's kind of amazing.
That's kind of, yeah.
We'll just very, very quickly ask about the scenes between yourself and Chris in this movie.
Yeah.
Because the joy of Thor and Loki is withheld from the audience for such a long time.
Yeah.
And then it's finally delivered. And in those scenes, how much of what Loki is saying to Thor is truth, in your opinion?
In all of them?
In all of them, yeah. From the off,
Are we still in our spoilery version of the podcast? Yes, we're still spoilery. How much of it is the truth? I honestly think Thor demands it of Loki at various points. I think Loki's grief at the death of Frigga is real. Mm-hmm. Because she's the last and only person who cares about his existence, and actually always did, I think. So there is, however begrudging, there's a love there, which I found moving. It's like it still keeps the character grounded in something human. And then there's a scene on the skiff. There's a sort of a dark elf skiff that they sort of corral to get into. Into the dark world, and Jane Foster is under the spell of the ether and is sleeping on the prow of the ship, and Thor and Loki just get into it. Mm. And he says something like, "What I could do with the power that flows through those veins," and Thor says, "It would consume you." And they just get into the nuts and bolts, and Thor says, "I wish I could trust you," and Loki's response is simply, "Trust my rage." Mm. And I think that is honest.
Yeah.
And I also believe that when Loki says, "I didn't do it for him," he also means it. I mean, of course, that's cryptic. It's a riddle. It's a trick. But whatever he's referring to, he didn't. Thor says, "I'll tell Father what you did here today," and it's absolutely true that Loki didn't do it for Odin. Mm. There are many, and I like the idea that that's a question,
yeah.
and the audience will make up their minds.
Yeah, is it Frigga? Is it Thor? Is it something entirely different?
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting because Thor, right from the off, essentially says, "I know you're going to betray me, but don't, because I will kill you this time." Mm. Whatever bond we had as brothers is now gone.
Yeah.
From that moment on, is Loki actively seeking to betray Thor, or is he, will he very much toe the line, knowing that the stakes are much greater this time?
I don't know. I mean, I think the way that he finishes up in the film is the greatest trick of all, because he didn't betray him.
Mm,
he saved the day, and he ended up on the throne.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So going back to what you said about Loki not being good at long term planning, maybe he's learned a couple of lessons.
Precisely, yeah.
But yeah, he doesn't. You know, and that's what's of course interesting about the trick of that. There is a trick of betrayal. You know, they get to the dark world. Thor takes Loki's handcuffs off, and the first thing you see is Loki takes out a knife and shanks Thor in the ribs again. And the audience probably go, "Oh my God, Thor, how could you be so stupid?"
Yes.
But it's, of course, an illusion, and we're dealing with the master of illusion. And my goodness, that's a fun thing to play.
Oh yeah, it must be. It's great. We've seen it twice. We're going to go back again and again just to see exactly what point on Svartalfheim Loki's betrayal occurs.
Right.
What moment the illusion
begins?
Takes place. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting line where Loki says, "You know, this plan of yours is going to get us killed," and Thor looks at him and says, "Possibly."
On that note, Tom Hiddleston, it's been a pleasure, sir.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
There you go. That's what Feige, Taylor and Hiddleston had to say. Now it's our turn, if you're still with us. Dan, you were on set.
I was.
As features editor, you looked around for somebody to go in this movie and your finger lighted on yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks for that, Dan.
That's all right.
How was it?
It was a good day. It was kind of a funny day, though, because it's one of those things where they say, "Hey, we're going to show you all this cool stuff, but we can't tell you anything." So I saw like all this concept art. They started showing me concept art. So I actually saw the ether, but nobody was saying it's the ether. They just showed me a picture of Natalie Portman standing next to a big sort of red, black, wobbly thing. and going, oh, she shouldn't be there, but what is it? Can't tell you.
Did they use that voice throughout? Can't tell you.
It was Craig Carl, the producer, showed me. A lovely guy, lovely fella. And he told me a lot without telling me a lot. But yeah, it was the whole angle of, you know, the battle for Earth is won, but the battle for the universe has just started, kind of thing.
Again, in that voice?
In that voice, yeah.
So what did you see actually being shot?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Helen, because I couldn't really say in the magazine feature, because I saw the scene where Thor and Jane return from Asgard back at Jane's flat in Greenwich, which is a very nice flat, by the way. Ooh. You didn't really see how nice it was in the film. But I actually wandered around that flat. She's got a piano and she's got an old school style telescope and she's got like an actual full on balcony. And I'm telling you something, Greenwich prices, I don't know how she afforded it. I theorized that SHIELD were paying her rent. But there's a line in the film about her mum or something.
Yeah, so they say it's her mum's flat.
So she's rich to have a place like that in Greenwich.
I wonder, is her mother British? Is her mother American? I want to know more about Mrs. Foster. We never see her. Who is she?
I bet Mrs. Fair Foster bet. Is going to be the new star of a Marvel one-shot. Can I just point one fact out about the piano? If you look on the piano, there's a song being written on the piano. You can see it on the stand, which is called Thor the Thunder God.
That's right.
Which I presume goes like this. Thor the Thunder God.
It's actually a song that exists. It's actually a piece of music that exists from a suite based on the Norse gods, I believe. But I cannot remember. I've got it in my notes somewhere. I've actually got my notes from the day right here in front of me. But I don't want to bore everyone by flipping pages till I find it.
So she wasn't writing it. She was just playing it.
It's just there. I thought it'd be like an Easter egg in the film, but you don't see it.
She's a bit of a creep, isn't she?
Who?
Jane.
What?
She's playing songs about her boyfriend.
He's a
Darcy
god.
Probably bought it for her as a joke.
Maybe. But anyway, so the scene that I saw, so they come in, but of course, I'm sitting there watching it on the monitors, and Stellan Skarsgård, who was actually in his pants at the time, and he actually said to me that he has more nude scenes in this film than he does in Necrophiliac.
Nymphomaniac,
Jesus.
The sequel nobody wanted.
There's a Freudian slip.
That scene, if we can jump straight into that scene, is the one in the screening I saw that really raised the roof, that had about three of the funniest moments, including, I think.
Oh, that was Thor hanging his hammer on the...
I think he didn't do that when I was there. Oh. He didn't do that. And also, weirdly enough, Ian, the intern's intern, wasn't there that day.
Hmm.
So that was a bit odd that that actor was not there. But anyway, it's a movie magic. But yeah, it was obviously Stellan goes, where's your brother? And he's dead. At which point the producer leant over to me and said, yeah, could you not put that in? And I'm like, yeah, I kind of wish you hadn't brought me here today, but there you go. But I kind of consoled myself by saying no one really stays dead in these,
of course,
films.
And, you console yourself with the line, I think I better get my pants, which is very funny. I better get my pants.
Yeah.
It also has that fantastic reaction from Stellan Skarsgård. When it's like, oh, your brother's dead, and he does his conflicting faces where he's so overjoyed that Loki is dead, but also, I have to show suitable sympathy for Thor.
So many takes of that line. Really? I actually saw loads of different versions of how he delivered that reaction. It was actually fascinating to watch.
So was there one where he was just like, woo!
No, he didn't go from the extreme. He kind of tried, he went with the full, oh, thank God, oh dear kind of thing, and then kind of blended the two and kind of... sort of contracted and expanded the reaction.
He has a great film, Stellan Skarsgård. He really has a great film. Just he's only in it for what, in total about 10 minutes?
He's great. He had the funniest bits as far as
easily.
I'm concerned.
I've had a god in my brain. Yeah, that would mess you up.
That's one of the things that really I really liked about this film, and I really like about all the Marvel movies, is that they're so funny. I mean, Man of Steel could have had, if it had an ounce of the levity that this movie has, the last hour of people throwing each other through buildings might have been tolerable, but I felt that Marvel really have the right approach for this sort of thing. They take it seriously, but not too seriously. And Stellan Skarsgård's hilarious. His scene in the asylum / old people's home / whatever it is that he's in with the great Stan Lee cameo.
The mad scientist time.
That is, I think, the best Stan Lee cameo we've had in a Marvel movie. I'm tempted to call it for that one.
All right, let's go through him. Iron Man.
The Hugh Hefner one was good.
That's Iron Man 1?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's he in Iron Man 2?
I can't remember.
Iron Man 2? Can't remember. Thor, he's pulling the hammer. He's trying to, he's going,
he's in the car,
He's in the car with the hammer. Incredible Hulk, what's his cameo?
He's one of in the Eric Banner Hulk, him and Lou Ferrigno are security guards.
They walk out of the building.
Yeah.
but in The Incredible Hulk.
In The Incredible Hulk, I don't remember.
So obviously a memorable one as well. Yeah. Avengers, he's on the TV going, superheroes in New York, give me a break.
But he was meant to have a bigger one in the deleted scene with Captain America, where Captain America is having a cup of coffee outside right. the station, and then he kind of gives him some advice on love and all that sort of stuff. I'm kind of glad they cut that out.
Mm.
Is he in Captain America?
Yes,
he's a general.
He's a general.
Okay. Oh, yes, he's sitting down in the...
Generalissimo.
He's in the X-Men films.
One of my favorite
films. He is in the X-Men films,
I'm trying to remember.
Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man is probably his best cameo outside of this one.
I'd say so.
He's the janitor who's a fight between Spider-Man and the Lizard is going on behind him. And he's got his headphones on, can't hear any of it.
He is quite good in the Fantastic Four sequel where he's trying to gatecrash the wedding in a way that completely mimics the comic. Clever.
Yeah, and he goes, I'm Stan Lee, don't you know who I am? And he breaks the fourth wall.
Deadpool.
Not the only thing
Fantastic
that film broke.
Four.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, it's a good cameo. Anyway, Dan, back to Sephiroth, because you had Loki's death spoiled for you, and also another death, didn't you?
Yeah, because they were messing around between takes, which again was quite fun to watch. Stellan just said, what about your mum? And Hemsworth went, nah, she's dead too. And I leaned over to the producer and said, is that actually in the script? And he went, no, in that voice. As we quite often shout at each other in the office, it's a professional hazard. You know, you're going to get things spoiled. I prefer to have things spoiled by, you know, actually being on set and seeing things being shot and talking to people who've made the film than, you know, Nick blabbing.
To pick a name from thin air, mean to say that Nick is the worst spoiler in the office.
I'm not sure he is, but it's fun to say that.
Okay, but so let's use that as a sort of springboard then to talk about other issues in the movie. Loki's death, first of all, because this movie is very interesting in its treatment of Thor. And Loki, and it finishes off with a very interesting shot, and we heard Kevin Feige and Alan Taylor talk about it quite a lot. Loki on the throne of Asgard at long last.
Mm. I really like the relationship in this film. I think it works really well, because I think at the beginning of the film, you know, their relationship is at the lowest ebb that it's ever been, in the sense that in Avengers, and really throughout Avengers, Thor, until the very last moments, Thor had hope that he could somehow talk Loki around, that he could somehow win his brother back over. Mm. And that proved a false hope. And so he begins this film with a really hardened attitude to Loki and a really kind of tough love non-approach, in the sense that he won't go near him. And they kind of come back around and Loki re-earns some kind of trust. And, you know, his last line before his death scene is, I didn't do it for him. And the implication is very, very clearly, as far as I'm concerned, I did it for you. My brother, or you can argue it's maybe for Frigga partly as well, but I think it's clear that there is some brotherly love there, which I think is great. Mm. And despite that line of people telling him he'd kill him if he betrays Thor, technically, he doesn't betray Thor at all. He betrays Odin, sure. And you could argue that...
Well, technically, he does betray Thor by faking his death.
Maybe
and
he lost consciousness
the throne
and
of
thought
Asgard.
He was dying.
And you could also read the I did it for him. I didn't do it for him line. You can read it many ways. You can read it, I did it for Thor, I did it for Frigga. Another way you can read it is, I did it for me. Because this is part of my overall plan.
But I choose to be a nice person and believe the best of people, even Loki. And I quite like the idea that there is some brotherly love there. And also I think the scene between the two of them on the sort of the skiff, I think is great. And I think that there is that line that sums up Loki's character like no other, which is that satisfaction isn't in my nature.
Yeah.
I think that absolutely sums him up. And I think whatever happens in the next one, you know, with Loki on the throne of Asgard, that's not going to be enough either. And it's going to be
he's going to get bored pretty quickly, isn't
he? Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see where that then takes him.
Hmm. There are two questions that spring to mind off that one. The first one is the final shot that we see. Is Odin a prisoner here? Is Odin dead? What has happened to Odin for Loki to be there?
Yeah, that's one of the big unanswered questions, isn't it? Which I imagine will be answered in Thor 3.
If Feige and Taylor didn't answer it, I guess Alan Taylor doesn't necessarily know. I don't imagine he'll direct the next Thor movie, because they tend to move on with the directors for the most part, Jon Favreau and Joss Whedon aside. But Feige, you have to wonder, does he even know at this point? Do they know he's somewhere? But I can't imagine they would kill Odin off screen. Yeah. I imagine he's somewhere. He's in a dungeon.
And also, could Loki do it? Isn't Odin like, you know, the biggest, baddest god of them all?
Well, there's a possible bunch of theories here. Okay, so let's get our thoughts around this around the table. At the very end of the scene when the guard, who is actually Loki, comes back and says, oh, Father, we found a body in the dark world. And the last shot of Anthony Hopkins, apart from the end when he's actually Loki, he turns around, he looks at the guard, and he says, Loki. And he's a bit Welsh there. He says, Loki. Oh, Loki. Is it Loki? And Loki goes, yeah, Loki. And you can read it two ways. One is that, oh, it's my son, Loki. And the other way is, as we discussed in the previous interview, the other way is, you're Loki.
That's definitely my reading.
If you read it that way, then you find
maybe
it difficult to believe.
Cahoots.
Maybe, but you find it difficult to believe that Loki would get the drop on Odin.
I think Odin would hesitate to strike down his son. And I think Loki would hesitate to kill Odin. That, I think, is probably what we're going to find happens. A, no one stays dead in comics, so even if he did kill him, it wouldn't matter. But B, I don't think he did. I think he has placed him somewhere, and Thor 3 will be about finding out where.
Maybe he's inside the ether.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, he's in that little ether thing.
Come on.
Sorry, that's a bit far-fetched.
Right, okay, right. Let's just go through my list.
I can see it being easily done. What you see at the end, actually, is just Loki sitting on the throne. Odin could be in the loo.
There's no actual
reason
on
for
the
Odin.
Other throne.
No, exactly. He's on the other throne. The slightly smaller throne, hopefully. But yeah, there's no reason to presume, because Loki has the power to change his appearance. Odin was off tending some roses outside in the garden. Loki just talks to his brother as if he's Odin.
So you're saying that Loki nips in, has a quick chat with Thor, and then relinquishes the throne back to his dad. It's a nice theory.
Odin comes back in, high fives his son, goes, how you doing?
Yeah.
Don't get too used to that scene.
Who's now a guard again. So you just keep sneaking around.
Anyway, my second question, going back to the scene we were talking about where Loki dies. I really liked how you kind of saw it coming, didn't quite see it coming, the way they said they set up that scene of them tumbling down the hill, which for me kind of echoed what happens in the Avengers. They're on that outcrop,
yeah.
And then they're together, one's in chain, all that kind of stuff. So you then get this sudden knife appears and you go, oh, crap. Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I think that was really well done, where you both saw it coming but didn't. And to pull that off in a big summer blockbuster, it's not an easy thing.
Yes, I think Marvel are very good at this. I think they're getting very, very good at this. As I think the reveal of the year was the Mandarin in Iron Man 3. And I think they're very, very clever. They know that if they just keep churning out the same movie again and again and again with no surprises, then people will get bored of it. But there's interest as well in that scene is that they almost foreshadow it. They almost think that you're going to kill Loki now when the fusion bomb or whatever it is that the Dark Elves have, the grenade.
I can help
goes
you out
towards,
here. That's,
please, what
that's,
is it?
That's dark matter. Those
yes.
are dark matter grenades. They're imploding people, not exploding them. They're imploding
they bring them.
Bring
them in, okay.
And they get folded up.
Which is a really nice weapon. It's a really cool, that's almost like a Neil Blomkamp level type of
weapon. It's a really nasty weapon.
I tell you what that is for me. That immediately made me think of Mass Effect, because there's a weapon you can use in Mass Effect, the game, which is called a singularity, where you throw an orb, and the orb pulls people in together to this area and hurts them.
Oh, wow.
And on the game references front, Portal obviously is huge for this. There's lots of fun to be had when you're introduced to the idea of going through different worlds, of having an infinite loop. Not infinity stones, but an infinite loop where you have that Coke can, what looks like a bottle of piss, going up and down, up and down, up and down. And there are so many shoes in this film.
Yeah, there's a
he
lot of shoe references.
The shoe, the coalescence, whatever it's called, the
convergence
with two shoes.
Mm. Yeah.
There's the shoe gag from Stan Lee with his one word. And then you get the shoes going through the portals earlier. It's just...
Yeah.
So you're saying Thor is a foot fetishist?
I reckon.
Maybe Tarantino did a pass in the script.
Well, no. You'd see more people without shoes on rather than the shoes without people in them.
That's true.
So,
but anyway, back to your singularity, dark matter.
So you think maybe that they're going to kill Loki at that moment. He's going to sacrifice himself heroically, which is a little moment I didn't quite buy, that Loki would push, but throw himself in front of Jane Foster.
I think he was under orders.
I took
that as very much part of the plan.
Okay.
And Thor was like, I'll do this. Your job is to keep her alive.
Okay, interesting.
So I think he was under orders.
By the way, I going back to an earlier point, I don't think Odin would stop himself killing Loki if it meant imperiling the Nine Realms, which is what Loki and the Throne of Asgard would do.
But he doesn't know that necessarily follows. He doesn't know immediately upon seeing Loki that Loki's going to strike him down and take the throne immediately.
We'll find out.
But I think there'd be a moment's hesitation.
He's in the loop.
He's a father as well as a god king.
You're talking about this movie not, you know, Marvel not repeating itself, wanting to not do the same movie over and over. I did feel like there were echoes back to previous films within this film, though.
Okay.
The way Loki dies is being shanked. I love that as a concept. Somebody is dying, then they take someone else and shove them on their chest, and the spear goes through and happy days. But that obviously echoes what happens to Coulson in Avengers.
Well, quite rightly, doesn't it? Shouldn't the guy who killed Coulson die in the same way?
And then come back to life in the same
and
way?
And come back to life
in
the same way, yeah.
They'll take out the blade sticking out like they did with the Avengers.
The other example is when Curse becomes Curse, he takes this pill that he shoved in his intestines, this rock, and then he swallows it, and then
he turns
into this huge monster. I kind of loved him, the visual look of him. It's kind of this Warhammer, for me, Viking thing.
Mm. Prosthetics rather than CG as well, which is always good.
But to become this twisted, powerful beast, it reminded me a lot of Iron Man 3. You have the red veins that come out and you kind of become this big red monster before you calm back down again. So it's a similar, they're using similar visual cues.
I've got a question about that moment. Maybe we could come back to it?
Go for it now.
Or is now the time?
Go for it now.
This is one of the things that kind of confused me, okay, in terms of the continuity of the film. Because you've got Malekith and Al Grimm, and Malekith says, I'm going to do this thing to you, kills you, and you've got to change, and I'm going to put this helmet on you. So he looks like one of the Marauders. They never named that in the film, but that's who they are. That they're fighting, that Thor and co. are fighting at the beginning of the film in Vanaheim. But before that scene's happened, the Warriors Three are taken all those Marauders prisoner and are on their way to taking them back to Asgard, right? Mm-hmm. That's happened before that exchange between Malekith and Algrim.
Well, yeah, but they've taken them prisoner on Vanaheim.
But Algrim and Malekith are in Svartalfheim.
Yeah.
Totally different realm.
Yeah.
And he puts the helmet on him, and then the next thing we see is that same group of marauders that they took from the beginning of the film, including the guy with the huge curly horns, into the prison, and Algrim's with them now.
But they have invisible ships, essentially, that are invisible to everybody else's technology. So it should be fairly easy, you would have thought, to... I mean, presumably they're holding them on Vanaheim until they're sure that they've rounded them all up.
Right.
Presumably.
Right.
And then he just joins that lot.
Okay.
Innit?
We didn't have time to ask us of Taylor and Feige, sadly. But my feeling is that there's a deleted scene there. There's a scene where Algrim, wearing a helmet, goes...
gets dropped in and
causes a ruckus and gets arrested by the Asgardians, the Warriors Three, who I think, is that the first time we've seen them on Asgard in the movie? I can't quite remember.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my feeling, that there might be a deleted scene.
Mm.
That was part of his plan. But in terms of, you know, the shorthand of here's a man, put on a helmet, and then, he's immediately in Asgard.
Okay.
I kind of got that. They were almost like the Warriors 3 were almost like space cops in that way, going rounding up people and bringing them back for the drunk tank. That's essentially what my feeling was, my interpretation was of that scene. But you could be right. You could
Fair
be right.
Enough.
You know, there might be a bit of a plot hole there. And I think the film, as we established a little bit with Feige and Taylor in the interview, was in flux up until the end, as most Marvel movies are. There's a lot of shifting around and additional shooting and
even the look. The Dark Elf ship and the Dark Elf technology and all that stuff. Yeah. That changed, didn't it, between trailers?
For example, in the scene that we know was shot quite late in the day and added quite late in the day, the first scene with Odin and Loki, that confrontation, references, there's a line from Anthony Hopkins which doesn't make a lot of sense in the context of the movie. He goes, you know, Frigga, your mother, you will never see her again. And then the next time we see her, she's talking to Loki. I mean, admittedly, she's doing it in a clandestine fashion.
Yes.
But it does. Some people could look at that and go, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. But then again, Odin may not know that she's...
I think that's very much the message there. Yeah. It's clear that she's always been close to Loki because, as you know, they say in the movie itself, she gave him her tricks.
Yeah.
Her
witchcraft. Kind of wanted to see more of that in a way. Again, it's weird. It's almost like I wanted this film to be a bit longer, you know, to you know, I do believe in show, don't tell, but I kind of like, there's certain things I just felt could have done with a little bit more illustration. Almost a flashback to Frigga and little Loki or something, and got a sense of that relationship. Mm-hmm. We didn't get it from the first film.
No, it's interesting. You look at the first film again, which I did recently, and I actually think I prefer this film to the first movie. Certainly the first 25 minutes of Thor is a very dense introduction to that world and those characters. If you look at it again, it's very interesting, and I think a lot of the Marvel movies, and a lot of even the ones that aren't Marvel Studios, they presume knowledge on the part of the viewer, I think. To the point where, if you look at Thor and Loki, at no point in the first 10-15 minutes of Thor are they actually introduced by name. You know, for example, they're just kids growing up, and then we see Thor. I don't think Thor is called Thor for the first 10-15 minutes of that film. Maybe I'm wrong. But you go back to like movies like Spider-Man 3, where Venom is never called Venom. Mm. That sort of thing. They just kind of presume that knowledge. And I wonder if it's slightly that also. But the beginning of Thor is quite choppy, almost as if it was made up of a series of scenes that were much longer. And I think there was more stuff with Frigg in the first movie.
I think sometimes that's a good thing. I think that's sometimes a strength of the Marvel movies because, admittedly, this is an extreme contrast. But if you contrast it to something like The Lone Ranger, which is so concerned with getting its own mythology laid out in detail so no one could possibly be confused about where anything in that film has come from. I mean, down to his mask. Did we really need an origin story for his mask? You know, all you need to know about Venom in Spider-Man 3 is that he is a bad, scary guy. And you know that whether he's called Venom or not. Mm. All you need to know about Thanos in Avengers is he is a bad, scary guy. And you know that even though he's never named and no one had any clue who the heck he was. Mm. And I kind of feel like, you know, as long as you make it clear that these two are brothers and there's a bit of something going on there, you know, his name can come in later.
Mm. Yeah, I've got to ask a question at this point. What the heck is an Infinity Stone?
Oh, Dan.
And how is something liquid a stone?
Well, obviously, shut up.
Can I just say there are quite a few obviously shut up moments discussing what we're discussing now. There are so many, obviously, shut up.
And also, who the hell was Benicio del Toro? I'm sorry, but what? He looked like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers out of Velvet Goldmine.
He looked like...
in Forbidden Planet. What's going on?
Ferrell in Zoolander is what he looked like.
Yes.
Jacob Mungatu.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Inventor of the piano key
necktie. Mr. Whippy, evil Mr. Whippy. In what looked like, an explosion in Forbidden Planet. What?
Let me see if I can help here. There is a line from Hopkins when he goes into his magic library with those books that I really want where the pictures move around.
It's you mean cool. Like iPads?
Like iPads, but a book. Really excited by those.
Oh, you mean Harry Potter?
Like a Kindle.
Like a book. Shut up. Anyway. So when he goes into his magic library with the magic tree also, he talks about there being artifacts from that are older than the universe.
Mm, that makes sense.
Most of them are stones, but this one is a liquid.
Yeah, I heard that line.
Right, so...
Right. But
how is he referring to a stone at the end?
It's not a stone. It's contained within a little thing in the same way that it was under the big giant thing. The thing that it's in at the end...
From big to small.
Magic. The thing that it's in at the end is actually even the same shape as the big giant thing that Natalie Portman found.
Loki iPad mini.
Yeah, it's basically an iPad mini.
So I felt a little bit, you know, I kind of, you know, I grew up reading comic books and what have you. I don't know the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff.
Yeah.
But in the audience that I was in, which actually all you guys were in too, when you know, evil Mr. Whippy says,
the collector.
Something about five of them or something.
Gotta catch them all.
And all these people went, woo-hoo. And I'm sitting there going, what the hell?
All right, what that means is that Marvel are laying the groundwork for the Infinity Gauntlet series, or for some version of the Infinity Gauntlet, which is Thanos, his big plan, his big thing is to get the Infinity Gauntlet, which is a glove that has all of the Infinity Stones on it. Once that happens, then he's virtually invincible.
Game over, man.
Galactus could kick his ass, man.
Okay, listen, we know that when bad guys get hold of things that make them invincible, it never works. Look at Malekith here. I want the ether. I got the ether. Oh, you just beat me.
Well, yeah, obviously. But that's why, you know, we have stories where the bad guys lose. But at the same
I was annoyed about that, Dan.
But
I
at the same time,
that.
You know, it's kind of cool. I think genuinely this is quite clever on Marvel's part that all their MacGuffins are uniting to form one mega MacGuffin.
It's MacGuffin's
almost
assembled.
Like, yes, the Avengers of MacGuffins.
Yes, it genuinely is.
Oh, it's called God. A MacGuffin.
A MacGuffin. And honestly, if you're going to have MacGuffins, why not have a MacGuffin?
It's an egg MacGuffin.
I think it makes perfect sense. They actually say in that mid-credit sting that the Tesseract, which was the MacGuffin from... Mid-credit sting, they say that the Tesseract from the Avengers is an Infinity Stone.
Okay.
The ether from this film is an Infinity Stone.
So there got to be like three other
two
films.
Down. Possibly.
With silly MacGuffins that
we might
people
be introduced
don't really
to
need.
A new one. And my feeling is that, you know, and second guess Marvel at our peril, but my feeling is that Avengers 3 will finally see Thanos be the bad guy, and it'll be about trying to stop him from wielding the Infinity Gauntlet, which means that no one, not even Agent Coulson, could stop him.
I'll be dead by the time that film's out.
It's only 2 years,
well,
then. You're not that old.
Yeah, let's look forward to it even more.
You just come in here and just piss on everyone's chips.
Okay, all right. Okay, my serious point is, right, I enjoy Thor, I enjoy the world, I enjoy Asgard and Midgard and Svartalfheim and all that stuff. Mm. I enjoy the way that the Norse mythology is parlayed into the Marvel Universe. It's all great. I haven't been enjoying this other setup stuff, as far as I was concerned, the ether, I didn't get the point of it. Fine, have the Dark Elves, they're bad guys, Malekith's cool and nasty, he's been banished, now he's back.
Like Zod.
And they fight him, and he's hard, and he's cool, and he's a threat, and he kills Frigga,
I don't think, honestly, it didn't interrupt my enjoyment of the movie. It's a MacGuffin, it's fun. I do wonder, and again, we didn't have time to talk about this with Feige and Taylor, I do wonder if there's another version of this movie where the ether has a slightly more malevolent influence on Jane Foster. There seems to be indications that she was going to be possessed by something and turn all evil and nasty-like. Hmm. There's moments when her eyes are dark like the dark, yeah. But maybe, who knows, maybe Mrs. Foster is the one who's possessed and evil, but...
That's another plot trick they've used in Iron Man 3, where you have the female counterpart to the hero pulled into this world by being contaminated with this superpower / malevolent bad thing. In this version, she doesn't get any actual powers, unlike Iron Man 3. Mm. By the way, if you haven't seen Iron Man 3, I do apologize, but if you're listening to this, then hopefully you have. But that kind of annoyed me. What bothered me is more what you were saying previously at the beginning of this, Dan, which was he gets the ether, but I feel like he's less powerful. He can't kill Thor with this superpower. Whereas with Curse, and that scene when they're dodging each other and he gets ether and walks away, I was like, I actually think people might die. I was nervous. Mm. I was scared. There was real force behind what people were doing. But when he has the ether, it's like... I don't know if you ever played the game Prototype. Hi, I'm referencing games today. But you shoot this kind of black liquid. It's almost venom-like.
Or like a football manager.
And you're just kind of shooting out this black goo. Mm. And you see him fall into a wall, fall into the gherkin, fall into wherever. Mm. But there was no real attempt of making that black venomous goo do anything bad to him.
I think at that point, maybe he's just focused on the bigger picture of destroying everything rather than destroying Thor, maybe.
Yeah, for him, I think Thor is an utter irrelevance. And it's one of the interesting things about, as I said in my review, that I think one of the reasons why Malekith, for me, doesn't quite work as well as Loki is that there's no personal investment between himself, Thor, and Loki. I mean, they try. They kill Frigga to make it personal and to send the brothers on a quest for vengeance. Mm. But there's no moment. I mean, I don't think Malekith even learns Thor's name during the course of the movie. He's just an Asgardian who just is a bit of a fly in the ointment, an insignificant speck, ultimately, once he has the powers, which to me were more reminiscent of the end of Blade when Stephen Frost becomes the blood god. He's regenerating and he's surrounded by this red liquid. That to me is what Malekith thinks of Thor. So he's not really bothered, to be honest.
He's not bothered by the fact that half his face gets scorched up.
He's fairly bothered about that.
I didn't really see much bother there.
Yeah,
they wear masks a lot anyway. So what do they care? But did they fridge Frigga?
Yeah, kind of. They did.
They fridge Frigga. Thank you. Get it, Argos. But unfortunately, it seems to be fine because they gave her this kick-ass bit where she defended Jane. I enjoyed that, but in retrospect, there's quite a few fridge moments.
Pretend, for example, that we're not all well-versed in film terminology and explain what fridged means.
Fridging is basically where there's two slightly different definitions. The much broader definition is that a female character is killed to give a male character something to feel. Killed, injured, tortured, raped, whatever. It happens a lot. The slightly more specific definition, which is what the inventor of the term, Gail Simone, actually intended, was that female characters, when they come back from being tortured, injured, killed, whatever, tend to come back weaker, whereas male characters, when they come back from being tortured, killed, maimed, whatever, tend to come back stronger. Either way, there is an imbalance in the force, if you will. Frigga is kind of fridged. Now, obviously, we had Taylor and Feige explaining why specifically she was the one that was chosen to die, because she was the only one who could bring Thor and Loki together. I get that. It did initially, when I watched the film, leave a slightly worried taste in my mouth. But
I was looking back at my review of the original Thor, and there's a line where it goes, some people don't get a lot of screen time. Rene Russo needs to have a word with her agent. And clearly she did have a word with her agent, but you do realize, especially the second time, you're going, they're giving her more screen time just so they can kill her. And make the impact.
A little bit.
And make that.
But it did impact. Have an impact, and that's why I'm having.
It did or didn't, sorry.
It did. And I think that's why I'm having trouble condemning it as much as I would like to on principle.
They got away with it,
kind of get away with it.
Especially when you hear, you know, it's interesting hearing how much flux that scene was in and how, you know, how much of a, how many repairs they had to make to it for it to come out the way it has. I thought it was fairly impressive.
Because, of course, there was supposed to be a Malekith Odin face-off.
Which would have been in that time, exact
yes,
moment.
Yes, in the feature in the magazine, Christopher Eccleston talks about having his big scene with Odin.
Yes.
So if you read the feature and then you've seen the film and thought that we were all going mad, no, it just didn't make the final cut.
I think it'll be on the Blu-ray, though, which is going to be very, very interesting. Your feature should be on the Blu-ray. It's so required reading for all Thor and Loki fans.
Well, let's blow our own trumpet for a moment and talk about the magazine, because if you got our subscriber cover, especially the Loki subscriber cover, which was much in demand, you will have noticed that there's a massive spoiler on it. And we didn't notice at the time.
I did think that after the film was finished.
But after watching the film, if you look on the ground beside Loki as he sits on the ruined throne of Asgard or in front of the ruined throne of Asgard, you can see that that's not his helmet sitting next to him. It's Odin's. And that's Odin's spear sitting behind him. And I don't think I've noticed anyone on any of our boards or Twitter or anywhere else point that out. Well, and yet here we are.
Yeah, true. But then again, they may just, obviously, Mjolnir is there as well. So
yeah,
it could just be he's surrounded, which is the my favorite moment in the movie by a country mile.
That hammer is the best comic actor of the whole film.
No, I love the fact that they remember that Darcy can't pronounce Mjolnir and they brought it back. And again, I just love the, like I said, the levity of that final scene, constantly wrong-footing his protagonists
as opposed to Man of Steel's hevity.
Yes.
Especially as it was, I found there was a patch when after the really cool-looking ships come in, the kind of half blades, the shanks start flying in with these red eyes and they cut up the buildings and this, there's a little bit of, is there a deleted scene here of, the bloobity beep shield is failing, not failing. I didn't quite understand what was going on there. But anyway, the ships come in and that's quite a low point and you feel quite slow and turgid. I never thought at that point we'd get, because it's sad, people are ruminating upon how this has all happened, you know, Asgard is vulnerable, that we have such a fun ending.
Mm.
Like, it is so much fun. Hammers and, you know, jumping through space, landing on the gherkin and smashing it through, the bit that every Brit or anybody who's ever been to London will get annoyed about when he gets off the portal at Charing Cross. Boom. He lands there, gets on, hot girl bumps into him on the train. That's great. How do I get to Greenwich? She goes, 3 stops on this line. No matter what line you are on.
She is lying.
At Charing Cross, you cannot get to Greenwich.
Is she lying just to get Thor onto the train with her?
I am on board with this.
She's on board with
she
it.
She is lying.
Possibly.
I mean, at best case scenario, you'd have to change onto the Jubilee. And even then, you'd be ending up in North Greenwich, which is at least the way he comes from when he runs back into the college. But it's a long walk from North Greenwich to the Naval College.
I remember when Charing Cross was on the Jubilee.
Also, I think one of the things that we should overlook over about this this scene is that he doesn't have an Oyster card. So, therefore, how does Thor get out of the station at Greenwich? Simple answer is he breaks the law.
I think the girl walks in with him. I'm not saying that you should do this, but it's conceivable that they could be hugging as they go through the barrier, touch, beep, go together. Look, I'm not saying he did that, but it's an idea. But as we're talking about things that you may be a little bit miffed about with this film, you know, it wasn't all super great. Can we talk about the general attitude towards science, how things work, plot machinations? There is so much wibbly-wab-wab in this.
There is. But at the same time, on Asgard, right, as Thor says himself in the first film, you know, there is no difference between science and magic. And it's something that I think Marvel has been playing with a little bit. I don't know if anybody out there is watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but you will notice the repeated references that Agent Coulson makes to his, apparently he recuperated from his Avengers wounds in Tahiti. That's the story on the show. And every time Tahiti is mentioned, he says, it's magic. And I think there's clearly something going on there.
Oh, I thought
there's
he was
something, explained. Maybe, but it's magic. There's clearly something going on here with magic, essentially being the same as science.
It's just a get out, isn't it?
Gravitrons
it's
and all this kind out. Of stuff.
It's
you
not
know,
just,
gravimetric
it's
stuff.
It's not just the magic
spatial extrusions.
Asgard, which I totally agree with what you're saying, but it's when you see Stellan Skarsgård with what looks like a wireless router I had 4 years ago, twisting it, little knobs on it, and then suddenly things are happening and people get disappeared into singularities.
But that's because he's controlling
portals.
The gravitrons.
Yeah, I have to confess that bit stuff. Of the film made no sense to me.
It
whatsoever.
Made a lot of fun.
But you just
fun.
Roll with it, don't you? You just roll with it.
And I love them being fine. Spears. You're suddenly throwing these spears at people, and then if you detonate them at the right time. I mean, I'd love to play that. That's a good game.
I don't think this technology exists. So I
think you don't think so? No, don't you reckon?
Otherwise, Brian Cox and Neil deGrasse Tyson would be our rulers. They would have this technology.
I'll tell you what annoyed me is that Thor is quite often during the film apparently wearing two cloaks. He's got his red cloak under his big blue leather cloak. That doesn't make any sense,
man. That's what you're nitpicking?
Yes.
A man is warm. You're just annoyed because Chris Hemsworth is covered up.
Okay, how did...
Well,
I've watched this movie with Helen twice, and the scene, the gratuitous male nudity in this film, by the way.
Topless scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Moobs out.
Yeah. There were...
Those were not moobs.
All right, whatever.
Yeah, whatever those are, they're not moobs.
Pexy.
Yeah.
You want plot problems? How does Mjolnir not break the coat rack? Hey,
Thor puts it down.
It's unparalleled. It's a weapon to destroy and a tool to build.
He puts it down on top of Loki at the end of the first film. Loki can't get up.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, but he can hang it
on
a piece of MDF.
I know why. It's because whoever is worthy, and that coat rack is worthy.
That's going to be the new Avenger.
There you go. The new Avenger is a coat rack from Thor.
Maybe that's Groot, our first look at Groot.
Maybe. That would be amazing.
A bit of Groot poking through the wall.
I'd also like to talk about the Game of Thrones-ishness that was brought over, probably not because of Alan Taylor being the director of episodes of Game of Thrones.
With all the boobs and people's heads being cut off.
No, but there was an element. There was more of a Game of Thronesy vibe when you see, when they're celebrating their victory.
That was good to see.
The kids were on their knees, which doesn't happen necessarily as much in Game of Thrones, but they're quaffing some ales.
I did like the quaffing. I did like the sense that Asgard is a place that people live in as opposed to stand around.
The throne room reminded me a lot of the bigger throne room in King's Landing.
Yes, it was closer to King's Landing. I did think it was a bit of a shame because they made a big deal of shooting in Iceland for Svartalfheim and using this real location, but it seemed so
could be CGI.
Layered over with visual effects that I never actually really got the sense it was a real location, which is a bit of a shame.
I kind of wanted a hat tip to Game of Thrones. You know, when they're shooting the arrows at Frieda's longship into Valhalla, somebody just get it wrong once.
They all hit.
But they all hit.
Every single
they
one.
Nail it. Like it's like they're good at it or something. That was a very interesting montage, seeing that happen.
I like that scene.
My issue with the funeral scene was, especially because you've got Fandral there, played by Zachary Levi, and that made me it made me think of Tangled with the lanterns, because that's also a big golden city and all these lights in the sky over a big golden city and people out on boats on the lake around this big golden city. Basically, it looks identical to the love scene in Tangled, and that's a bit confusing for a funeral.
I wrote that down. Did anybody get any 2001 vibes, not just from the monolith that kept the ether in check, like some kind of big stone sandwich? But I found it was the room at the end of 2001 A Space Odyssey, that white, clear room with a couple of bits of furniture in it. That reminded Loki's prison cell reminded me of that.
I can honestly say I didn't get a single 2001 vibe.
I'm not saying it's like a reference. I just, did anybody feel that? No?
Okay. I did a little bit.
Okay, fine. I really liked how you saw Loki's reaction to Frieda's death, where he just shoots everything across the room. And the way it's cut in the trailer, it feels like he's angry at Thor, but in reality, what am I saying? But in the construct of the film, it's not that.
One of my favourite moments of the whole film is a quiet moment, and that was the bit where Curse is letting everyone out. Mm. He's walking through, he's letting everyone out, and they're all, and then he walks up to Loki's cell, and Loki looks at him, and he looks back, and he's just like, nah, you're staying in there, mate. Because I love this idea that just by giving this guy a look, Curse could just say, you're trouble. You're too much trouble for me. I'm not even going there.
But then he says,
I think that was a really nice, a strong, cute moment.
My feeling about that as well is that maybe Curse is letting everyone else out. And you look at them and they're all big, big bruisers who'd be very, very useful in taking Asgard down from within. And this guy looks like he's an Asgardian accountant, basically. So why would you let him out?
No, I think it's the other way around. I think he sensed that Loki was more... would be too much for him to handle.
Okay. When you see him deliver the line, which I really liked, of, you know, now you see me, I felt there were kind of magic jokes within the text. You see him playing with a cup when he's lying on the chaise along his bed. Mm. It seems to be a kind of cup and ball game type magic-y stuff. And him saying, now you see me, I expect him to go, no, you don't, and then just disappear into the smoke.
I actually wasn't a big fan of the way, having seen the film now, it would have been nice if that moment had been truly revealed to us for the first time. But
with the long hair and the disheveled Loki, but we see him in the trailer.
Yeah.
And I think that's the pretty much the only moment across three films that we see the true Loki.
Yeah.
That's truly him.
With the glamour.
The glamour, the glamour is away, and yeah. That's what David Copperfield's like in his days off, I think.
That's a horrible thing to say. I've got a couple of other points just to put out there that I noted down. ITV News is the foremost superhero correspondent, it looks like, for
this world.
Is that
a local
world.
Territory thing, though? They're, like, in America, it'll be an American news channel. In China, well,
it'll
be a Chinese
news
channel.
That would be in London, so it
wouldn't
make a lot of sense.
There was a scene earlier on when they're in London, and I'm pretty sure I saw a poster of Uncle Sam in the background saying...
Yes, but that is actually... That made no sense geographically because they were clearly having lunch on her date with Chris O'Dowd. She was clearly in the Royal Festival Hall in the restaurant there, Skylon. And then when she came out with Darcy, she was clearly next to London Bridge Station opposite that World War II museum, which is where that poster was. So that made just no sense.
Oh, so that poster does exist.
Yeah,
okay.
It's the World War II.
London geography is a perennial problem for people to get the shooting rights in certain areas. You just cannot make things join up. Like people, I mean, it happens all the time. People cross the river several times, Southwark, then over again, just because that's just the way they have to shoot.
Ladies and gentlemen, Furious 6 is car chase, for example.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. Can we talk about, this really delighted me, when you're seeing the things that they're testing the portal out on, one of the things they pick up was Vimto, a can of Vimto. And I thought, that's what they're toasting in Croydon. It's a can of Vimto. That's what they use for their toast.
But and Shreddies as well.
Shreddies, the AC McVitie's. Yeah. I don't know, it felt genuine. The prop guys obviously had fun with picking whatever it was. And Vimto just delighted me because I couldn't think of more British soft drink. Bar Iron Brew, that's probably it.
Mm.
So I enjoyed that. And what was the ringtone? What was Jane Foster's ringtone?
Was it Exhibit?
If you are Exhibit and you're listening to the podcast, do write in and tell us what song that was. There's a couple of really nice cameos in the film I think we should probably talk about.
Yeah. Great ones.
We've heard about from the interviews with Tom Hiddleston and Feige and Taylor about the Chris Evans one, but I really liked the Captain America cameo in this.
That was great.
Yeah.
It was kind of recognizing what irks people about Captain America in a fun way, that kind of you know, Boy Scout patriot thing. And it was good to see Chris Evans playing Tom Hiddleston playing Chris Evans.
Yeah.
And
given, Helen, you had a run-in with another Chris Evans during the screening.
Say no more.
Which one do you prefer?
I prefer the Captain America Chris Evans. I'm just going to go on record with that for all time.
I realised the other day when we were recording the podcast that I should have said at some point, perhaps he ran out of the screening early because he'd forgotten his toothbrush. But I realise now the moment has passed.
The moment has passed.
So
like about 15 years ago, I'd say.
Probably, but listen... Maybe we'll keep it in, maybe we won't.
Maybe we will.
So there's another cameo, which is Chris O'Dowd as Richard, Jane Foster's would-be boyfriend.
I thought that was really nicely played. I genuinely did. I thought, you know, that their disastrous date at the beginning is rather well observed in terms of the awkwardness.
Is it lobster?
Seabass.
You do wonder about how they got together, though. Was it on the Guardian Soulmates page?
I would say she's a Guardian Soulmates kind of girl, wouldn't you?
Do you think?
I mean, she wouldn't be on Match.com and eHarmony seems a little bit too dry for her.
I think they were both walking with ice creams in their hands in opposite directions and then bumped into each other and she got ice cream on him by accident.
Wow, you've clearly written the fanfic already.
Richard and Jane slash fiction, eh? Wow, interesting.
I reckon it was low-key Harmony.
Oh no.
It was what I like most about the Chris Evans one is it just kind of flowed. It was just like, there it was. You couldn't believe it. Yeah. It didn't have time to deal with it and it carries on.
Yeah.
Which almost in my head, I just go, watch this film again.
In the second screening, which we were at, which was the most crowded one, you literally couldn't hear a word that he said in that cameo because people were laughing so hard.
And applauding
everyone,
as well.
Which is really interesting. Which was pretty cool. But no, Chris O'Dowd, and I thought that it was nice that they made like sort of actual plot use of him afterwards, even though it did rather end up getting his Poor Little Hopes up in a way that seemed doomed
very
to failure.
Cruel. Very cruel.
It's handy they walked into that cave, I'll say that much.
It is a little bit, yeah.
But yeah, I love that moment. That was funny. And seeing all the shoes on the floor and then your brain goes, oh, I see what's happening here. This is kind of genius. Did anybody else enjoy the fact that at the end of the film it does go, Thor will return?
Yes, I like the confidence of that. That's something James Bond used to do from the very first Bond film, in fact.
Still does.
Yeah. And I think let's do it with good characters as well. Oh yeah, I went
And of course
there.
The fact is they know he will return because they're about to start filming his next movie, so...
And why did the film... on the bus, we saw this in certain press stills early on, but we saw the bus, which is for some reason in the Naval College, says moral sacrifice on the side.
A clue?
A clue to what? Is that a reference to something? Could we find out?
To a moral sacrifice, perhaps?
Maybe.
Reference to Loki?
Yeah, maybe. It could be. Anyway, I enjoy noticing it there. I feel like there's a story about it.
I enjoyed you enjoying that.
Oh, thank you.
I thought it was a fairly deftly written screenplay. It's credited to three writers, and Joss Whedon apparently came on and did some patch-up work on the screenplay. And I quite like the way it pays. It gives each character, including the Warriors 3 and Sif, yeah, nice little moments.
Mm. Ian, the intern's intern.
Except, yes, Ian, the intern's intern. Except with the one exception of Hogan, who is dumped on Fanaheim at the beginning of the movie going, well, here you are. Here you are at the beginning of the movie. You're probably too busy to commit to the larger part in this film. So enjoy. I will see you again at the end of the movie.
Spend some time with your wife and kids. Go on.
To be fair, does do a thing which I'm going to incorporate into my general physical lexicon. I've written a blog about things that I've picked up from movies that I enjoy, like in Iron Man, he does the double click and then claps into his hand.
What's your hand there?
What Thor does with what's-his-chops is the elbow-to-hand super handshake, because real men shake like that. They grab each other's hands and arms.
Yeah.
Let's do it, Dan.
That's it.
Oh, that's manly. Yes.
Oh, it's so manly. Wow.
If only you can feel the power
coursing through my veins.
I just got my first chest hair.
A couple of lines that I really enjoy within the film. How space? Space is fine. You lied to me, I'm impressed. There were loads of little moments that I know I'm going to enjoy
zings,
more.
A lot of zings.
The little exchange between Thor and Loki, which I think summed them both up, and I know I've said this in the interviews already, but Loki saying, satisfaction is not in my nature, and Thor replies, surrender is not in mine. I thought that just both of them in a nutshell. I'm in a nutshell.
Yeah, I like all the exchanges between Thor and Loki in this movie. It's interesting that the movie holds back the Thor and Loki stuff for so long. It's about an hour, I think, before they have their first scene together. And then when they do, and the movie does this, they do this really smart thing where they have a Thor-Loki confrontation, but they don't have a Thor-Loki confrontation.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting. I think they realize that for three movies of these people meeting and fighting, it's time to play a few different notes on the old flute.
The other line that's great is Loki's response to Volstagg's threat. Evidently, there will be a line to kill him if he betrays Thor. I think that's just great.
That was funny too. Maybe I wrote this down and it didn't actually happen and it was just in my brain, but does Loki shout the words Tada as he's flying?
Yes, he does.
The asterisk-shaped ship through that crack in the...
Skiff, I believe it's known as.
Right?
Yep.
And he shouts Tada. That really made me laugh.
Talk about magic references.
Magic potion. Oh, yeah. I see what you did there. Very good.
Yeah.
Asterisk.
No, he wasn't even talking about magic, but
I was adding a...
Yeah, I was with you.
Thank you, Helen.
These two were not with you.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Lost it completely. Anything else? And he disappears from the last third of the movie, really, but Heimdall, more Heimdall this time, more Idris Elba.
Great, yes. More scenes of him talking to Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah. Heimdall without his helmet.
It doesn't even matter, just the voices are fine.
Yeah.
Heimdall having a drink.
Yeah.
You know, that was weird. That was strange.
Him sacrificing himself, was that a moral sacrifice
kind
as well?
His honour?
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I thought, what are they going to do with this? And then it turns out he has to kind of admit that he's part of a plan, and I kind of love that. But it was odd. You go back up to Asgard after you see Jane and Thor together holding, hugging, and then they leap off and you can see the print on the floor, which I thought was really cool. But that, for me, reminded me so much of a crime scene that Luther would be involved in, that whole area. And we haven't talked about the final sting, which is again in that kind of warehouse in the middle of London, but not really, area, where you see these upturned shipping crates just there, and the giant stone monster from wherever... Mm.
A troll thing?
Dragony job. Is there chasing, like a big cat chasing birds? Mm. Just a lovely little kicker joke.
It's adorable.
It is adorable.
It's very, very nice indeed. I do like it. And I think maybe one last thing to talk about is, and it's very, very easy, obviously, to read post 9/11, lots of movies as post 9/11 analogies, but I think there's definitely something going on here with this movie. The Dark Elves, it's very noticeable at the beginning, for example, that Malekith basically turns his entire people into suicide bombers, which is very interesting. And you could also read Odin's intransigence as maybe being a comment on US foreign policy in the wake of it. But then it's easy to do this with pretty much every...
Well, Asgardians are like the Americans. They're the policemen of the Nine Realms. In America, he's obviously a policeman of our world. And you know, there's certainly that kind of stuff going on.
But the treatment of Odin in this movie is very interesting as well, because there's signs that he's losing his touch, that he's not the surefire deity that he once was.
Mm. I think there are lovely echoes. I mean, in terms of the Malekith being willing to sacrifice his people, Odin at one point at least being willing to sacrifice Asgard itself to defeat Malekith as well. You've also then got Odin berating Loki for trying to set himself up as a god on Earth, and Loki going, well, what did you do that was any different, essentially?
Double standards
all the way through. So I think that's kind of the interesting way of looking at Odin's behavior. He's echoing other people's bad choices.
So it looks as if we're obviously going to see Thor next in Avengers Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. It's going to be a while, I think, before we see Loki. I'd be amazed if a third Thor movie... Obviously, much will depend on how it does at the box office, but it's already shaping up to, I think, be one of the biggest November openings of all time.
Yes,
if not the biggest opening of all time. So I imagine we'll see a third Thor greenlit very, very soon. You looking forward to seeing that? Because it's such a cliffhanger in a way.
Yeah.
So it's a finite ending, but also I want to see what happens next.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fantastic. Literally fantastic.
Literally fantastic.
Literally fantastic. But as long as I keep these whatever Infinity Watsits out of it, I'll be happy.
You want them to keep the MacGuffins that will fuel Phase 3 out of Phase 3?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just stop Infinity Stones.
Just worry about the characters more.
I think they're worrying about the characters a lot, and that's why they're not bothering too much with the MacGuffins.
Stop distracting me from the characters with the MacGuffins.
I think you're the only one getting distracted, but fine.
It's a post-credit sting.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm a total, I like comic books, I like fantasy, I like sci-fi, I like men with big arms. I mean, this is pretty much in my wheelhouse. So I had a hugely good time, and I will queue up to see Thor 3 when it comes out. Oh, that's fun to
will
say, isn't
up,
it?
No, will I won't. Will you just go to a screening for free?
I'll go to a screening, if I can, I hope.
All right. And that is it, I think. Everything covered. We're all good. Everyone's happy. Okay. That is it for our Thor the Dark World spoiler special. Join us next time. I think the next spoiler special is going to be The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. So do check that one out in December. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Dan.
Farewell.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Vale.
Maybe I should have done a Godspeed. Now
all right,
I feel
bad. I'll do it again. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Godspeed.
Mm-hmm. It's goodbye from Dan.
Farewell.
It's goodbye from Ali.
Vale.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get my hands on Mew Mew. See you next time.